Thank you for listening. We are back with another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smulders, and with me is Laurie Harrison, who has been absent for quite a while. Laurie, you want to talk about that?
Well, it's good to be back. I have been gone for 5 months to France, and I'm really grateful that to Rosie Sumner, who sat in and did the interviews with Ali for the last number of months. They were fun to listen to and catch up on when I got back. So tonight we're interviewing Greg Ewart about the old days, his first years on Lopez. Greg has been around for many years, and we'll hear the details on that.
So Greg, you want to tell us how you got here and where you came from?
Sure, I'd like to. I first need to make a disclaimer, though. These are memories, and my wife will tell me my memory is not really great. So if it is not accurate, you can call our house 2682 to get the real story. So, but really, it's kind of I liken our paths sometimes to when you graduate from high school and you make a choice of where you go to college. And it's fascinating, really, because it is life-changing. And in my case, I was in Michigan and came out to University of Washington to study architecture, historical architecture, under Victor Steinbrück. And, of course, his son, David, lives on the island, and I've had his daughter, Marina, in my classroom. So I came to study architecture at University of Washington, and I was in my first year of school, and somebody came up to me at winter break or March break or whatever it was and said, hey, do you want to go up to the San Juans? And I thought, well, Puerto Rico sounds great. Let's go. And lo and behold, it was actually up in the San Juan Islands, and we all put in $20 and jumped on a 60-foot-old boat in Seattle and charged up to the San Juan Islands. And we got off at James Island, and our first stop, and we didn't know each other very well, so the eight of us just scattered among the islands and watched an absolutely incredible sunset, and all came out of the woods almost at the same time. And but looking at that sunset, I said, this is it. This is where I'm going to live. I can't believe I found it. And
How old were you at that time?
I was 19. Wow. And it took me a number of years to get back to it, but I knew that's where I was going to live. And we went to Stewart and Susha at the time. At Susha, a lot of people know about the phosphorus here on the island. We'd dive in and you could see the streaks of bodies underwater. It's beautiful. So I had found the place I was going to live, and it just took many years for it actually to manifest itself where I came up here. And it happened that I went through a number of changes and ended up teaching school. This was the late 70s at a place called the Little School in Bellevue. And we were sitting around the table one day, and a woman, Jean Dowling, was there and said, you know, I need some counselors up at this camp. And I said, well, where is it? She said, well, Lopez Island in San Juan Islands. I said, sign me up. And I signed a contract right then and came up and worked 2 summers and fell in love with Lopez. And shortly after, actually, I went to Alaska and taught school up there and came down one summer looking for land. And the land prices at that point were $3,000 an acre for a 5-acre piece. And I went, oh, my gosh. And I looked and didn't see anything and came back the next summer, and the price has gone up to $6,000. So I said,
wow.
I'm going to buy a piece. And I second piece of land I looked at, kind of an interesting story, was Carol and Al Steckler had divided their 20 acres. And so I went and talked to them, and they said, well, we're keeping these 10. You can divide the other 10. You want 5? That's great. You can divide it the way you want. So I walked the land and came back and drew on the map what I wanted. And so we agreed on a price, and I put $1,000 down.
Wow.
And we signed a contract. In that point, they were living in an old Army surplus tent with 3 peaks to it, and their kids were young and running around, and they put windows in this old Army tent. And there we were sitting at the table, and I signed the contract, and they said, well, how much do you want to pay a month? And I said, well, how about $250? So I said, okay, great. And so we signed the contract, and that's how I got my first land on Lopez.
Did you have a 10-year contract?
Well, it was however long $250 lasted. I think it's 22 and a half years. So, but an interesting thing happened. I agreed on some balloon payments of $1,000 every 6 months for two or three balloon payments. And I was working in Seattle making $8,000 a year as a teacher. And so obviously money was tight and I didn't have the money. And I thought, oh my gosh, I know they would be nice and probably give me some leeway, but I just didn't have any money. And I had my Volvo, you know, anybody on Lopez has owned a Volvo or a Volkswagen at one point. And I had my Volvo on the street, and it was a week before this payment was due, and a car went around the corner and hit the fender and left a note. And so I called their insurance company, and they said, what was it? And they said, well, I tell you what, we'll give you $1,000. You can keep the car. So I took that check and sent it up to Carol and Al and said, thank you, here's my next payment. So that's how I got land on Lopez, and it's such a treat to... you know, have a piece of land, and the first thing I did was take a 2x4 and threw it on there and said, this is my land. And next thing I did was go down to Richardson's store and buy a mailbox and put a mailbox up.
Oh, that was a good feeling.
It was a great feeling.
And when was that? What in the year?
1979 is when I came. Now, you know, I'm kind of a newcomer because there's a lot of people that have been here longer, but that's
everybody
when I came.
Everybody we interview says that, by the way.
But I didn't move up here till 89, and so in the intervening years I did carpentry work with a number of people on the island, and I'd come up summers and come up in weekends. And since I'd lived in Alaska and lived in a wall tent up there, that's what I bought here. I bought a $100 10x12 wall tent, and this is kind of an interesting little note. Instead of going straight to the ground, I actually built a platform and made it kind of classy, you know, so it came up off the ground a little more headroom. But I needed some slab wood for the side of the wall tent, and I heard Mark Brown had an old sawmill. So I went over to Mark, and I said, golly, Mark, I need a bunch of slab wood. And he said, I don't really like to get rid of it too much. And, but he said, you know, if I had a bottle of Jim Beam, some of that stuff could go, you know. So I went to the store and I bought two bottles of Jim Beam and gave it to him. And he said, help yourself for all you want. So the slab wood on my wall tent, which is just about ready to go now, is, you know, cost me two bottles of Jim Beam.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Beautiful.
So that was the early days, you know, and... And actually, so I came up in the summers and spent a lot of weekends coming up. And but then eventually Nancy and I met and we got married. And I was offered two jobs, one on Shaw Island and one up in Gustavus, Alaska.
Oh.
And I thought this was a new marriage, so I decided to take the job on Shaw and keep my marriage intact rather than disappear into the Alaskan wilderness. But... So we came up and lived in that little wall tent, and the other building I had built, I have to credit Dwight Lewis. Back in those days, Dwight would go up to Canada and with one of his big trucks and come down with loads of cedar, cedar siding or cedar paneling, and you'd put an order in. And Dwight was off to Canada, and I said, well, I'll take $70 a cedar, and I built a little 7-foot by 9-foot cabin in the woods. There was going to be a sauna that eventually became the bedroom for my wife Nancy and I. So he brought that down. I went and got utility 2x4s, and I think that cost me another $25. And Chuck Deach had Sunset Lumber at the time. And I looked behind Sunset, and there's all this siding. Well, this siding piled up. A lot of it was rotting. And I said, geez, Chuck, what are you going to do with that? He said, got to get rid of it. I said, well, can I take it? And I said, great. So I went and got that, and I think once I got the stain, I had the building built, and then, and I'm going to forget his name, I think Charlie Greenway might have been his name, but he lived on the corner where Dale Shreve and Cindy live right now. I had got a fro, and I found these cedar bolts, and so I didn't know how to split cedar, you know. I mean, make it real shingles or something. So I went to him. He was in his 80s at the time, and he was great. He said, let me show you how to do it. And he took that old cedar bolt and cracked that and showed me how to flake off those cedar shingles. And he said, some boys, they like to flip it over and then split it and then flip it back. But he said, let me show you how the old fart does it. And then he split me another one. So I took that back and split all my cedar shakes. And I think the whole building cost me $150. But back then, you know, all of us were didn't really like to deal with the building department. So any building you built, you had to build it under 120 square feet. Otherwise, you had to get a building permit. So all my buildings are like, 10 feet by 11 feet, 11 inches. You know.
And is this still standing?
The sauna, it was going to be a sauna, but it ended up being a bedroom, and that is still there. And the tent cabin's getting toward the end of its life, but I finally had them grandfathered in, by the way, just so they're legal now. Mm-hmm. But Chuck Deitch, of course, was the building inspector at the time, and
right.
So he took care of people in a very, very kind way. It was real friendly in that way. Plus, he sold you the lumber too, so you know, I don't think there was a conflict of interest there. But he sure wanted people to keep building.
Well, you know, so when I know a lot of people, the stories that we've heard so far, a lot of people when they got here, they didn't just buy, they bought the raw land and got started little by little, piece by piece, like you're talking about, Greg. You know, this was the day when I was back in Seattle and we bought a house and we had keys and running water and hot and cold and a nursery for the kids, but so many people that we've spoken to here didn't have hot and cold running water or maybe any running water when their babies were born, living in a teepee or a mobile home. And there was a community. I mean, that's how a lot of people got started here, isn't it?
It was. I mean, life was pretty simple. And we were just like everybody else. We built this little tent cabin and, you know, when I got married, I knew I had to take care of my wife. You know, you got a new wife and, you know, bring her up to this little place. And there's, you know, we had kerosene lamps and no running water. And it was great in the winter when everybody's water froze or the power went out. We were just happy as clams. We didn't even know that it was true, you know. But just for my wife, I built a little 6x8 addition onto the tent cabin that had an indoor sink.
Oh, God.
So that she wouldn't divorce me.
Oh,
but
all this time, were you having dreams of this gorgeous big house that you eventually did build? Or, I mean, was this a pretty temporary solution? Or were you guys
It was permanent until she got pregnant. And at that point, well, we used to take showers at IMC.
Okay.
And a lot of people did that, you know, and you'd go down and take showers at IMC. And sure enough, back then, you know, things were really honest. I mean, I remember one time leaving a stack of quarters at the, you know, the shower house there and coming back a week later and they're still there.
Beautiful.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But
happen today. That could still happen today.
I think it could, yeah. But no, we'd go down there. But one time we were going down and I had finished my shower and Nancy was still taking her shower, and she wasn't quite done, and I heard this big bam, and the transformer went out. Mm-hmm. And she got caught with soap in her hair, and she had a few words for me. Basically, it said, I want running water.
Okay.
She didn't say it quite in those terms, but I understood what she meant. So we said, we got to do something. So actually, what happened was we said, mobile home, that's the only way to get a temporary house. So we went over to Mount Vernon and went to one of those used mobile home places. And this guy saw us coming. He had a cowboy hat and had a gap between his teeth about 3/4 of an inch. And saw us, hi, I'll sell you a mobile home. And we went, oh, my God. So we passed on that. But it turns out through Nancy's research, we found one on Lopez. And it was the best deal we've ever had. We spent $6,000, bought this mobile home, had MR move it onto our land, and had Louis Washburn come and witch our land for water. Because, of course, we didn't have water at the time. And I had some experience with Louis before. He's a wonderful guy, and I'm sure he could find water. But Nancy was pregnant at the time, and so we were getting desperate to get in the house. And he came to us, and he said, oh, she's pregnant. I can tell you if it's a boy or a girl. Well, we had just had the amniocentesis the day before, and we knew it was a girl. And so he took his old stick, and you know, it wiggled this way and that way, and said, "Oh yeah, you got a boy in there. Got a boy in there." And we, and we said, "Okay, Louie, now you're going to go find us water, right?" So off he went to find us water, and sure enough, he found water. He said, and we went down, and we did get a well dug that did provide some water, and okay. So Louie got the water, and then we got this mobile home moved through MR and cleaned all this out, and of course the little cabin in the woods where Nancy had gotten pregnant, and he said, "This is the," and we always slept so good. He said, "Oh, this has rocks that have this incredible radiation around it, and that's why you sleep so well." So, I, you know, to this day, it's a great place to sleep. Anybody wants to come over, that's still out there. But anyway, so we got the mobile home, and we had it for 6 years. And two of our girls were born. Lily's room was in the little offshoot room there where the washer and dryer were, and it worked really quite well. However, I got to tell you, that was 89, and those were the big storms. You probably had people talk about the storms. Mm-hmm. And the first storm that came through was in November, I think. And you know, I was teaching at Shaw, and I commuted by boat every morning. And cruised over by boat, and then I'd go to work and come back. And we heard the wind howling that night, and you know the story. I mean, it dropped 40 degrees, and the wind got up to 90 miles an hour. And so I got up, and our little cabin had trees all over it. And I'm telling Nancy, "Well, I'm going to work," and she said, "Oh yeah, right." The ferries had shut down and all that. So we just ended up surviving, barely. And we had the mobile home on the property at that point. And so we ended up camping in there because there's a wood stove in there. And no power or anything. Of course, no one had power. But we had a Honda generator, so we turned that on and ground up some coffee beans so we could have coffee, you know. And we ended up, you know, surviving in that. It was pretty hairy.
Wow.
We had a tree that was leaning toward the mobile home that was about ready to cut it in half. And I went out in the middle of the storm and cut it so it just clipped the corner but missed the mobile home. But there, everybody had stories about that time then. But we got in the mobile home just before Emma was born, and I'm still married. And then we were there for 6 years, finally sold that. Uh-huh. And, of course, no one wants to move mobile homes. Finally, we got Skip Clark to move the mobile home, and Tom Jeffries and Celia bought it. It's still down there at their place. And, of course, it blocked the road for about half a day trying to get it in. And, you know, moving mobile homes is quite, they're not made to move very much. So, but that's after that we built a home.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a past, I was an architecture student for years, so it was a wonderful process for me to build it. And I had a couple people help frame it. Bill Moody was my main man there. And so we got the house built, and, you know.
How many square feet is that house?
It's pretty big. It's about 2,400.
Is that all? It seems like a big, big house.
Well, as a frustrated architecture student, I built a little model, and, you know, it seemed to get bigger and bigger as it went. But, you know, we built it so that we're going to sell it and get something smaller on Lopez.
Oh.
And so it's really a retirement. Okay. Investment.
Okay.
And also so to bring our girls up and have people come and enjoy. And, you know, so that was quite a process. And, of course, it's not finished. I mean, you know, we wouldn't be on Lopez with a finished house. So.
That would break the mold.
It would.
Was Claire born in the house?
Well, she was, when we were living in the house.
Right.
She was, Clara was,
she was the
our
last one.
One. Right.
Yeah.
I remember when I moved here in 94, you know, a lot of my peers at that point, a lot of our peers at that point, still didn't have, still were using their outhouses. They had houses by then, but they had outhouses and were still using wood for their heating inside.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seems like around 98 or so, everybody started getting electric heaters in their houses and made sure they had indoor plumbing. But it seems like a lot of people did fine with outdoor plumbing and, I mean, outdoor outhouses, no plumbing, and wood stove heat up until their 40s, through their 40s.
Yeah.
And then things changed.
Things changed.
End of their 40s, everybody decided, no, they'd like a few more creature comforts.
Right, right. Well, our kids were all trained to just go pee outside and poop outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we were building our house, we put in the septic tank, and Emma wanted to know what that was for, and the little round thing on top there had a handle on it, and said, well, that's where all the poop's going to go. And she said, oh, so next thing I know, I look out there, and she'd lifted it off, and she was pooping in the septic tank.
So, oh, she may not like that story going on there.
that's
just grand. Oh,
but, you know, at that time, I mean, I think the beauty of Lopez is that, you know, if you go to the city, people are they have specific skills and talents. But the beauty is here, I was in a men's group for years and years, and I'd look around my men's group, and almost everybody in the men's group built their own home. Mm-hmm. And you'll never find that in the city. And I know what something that changed my life on Lopez was the passage of Hugh Lawrence, mm-hmm. Lisa's husband. And he was in our men's group, and he had two young children, and we were exactly the same age at the time. He was 49 when he became sick. And, you know, it just struck me as, like, we never know when our life is over. It can happen to us at any time. And, you know, we've lost some very, very dear people on this island by surprise. And at that point, I was part owner of a backhoe and part owner of the sawmill. There's a sawmill group that we bought out, Mark Brown's old sawmill. And I just said, you know, I'm getting rid of all that. If I don't finish the house, so be it. Because I'd be teaching in the day, and then we lived in the trailer, and I'd work till 1 or 12 or 1 at night. And I just said, you know, it's time to devote to our family. And that's actually when we started looking at going overseas. Mm-hmm. Eventually, with the Fulbright, went to England for a year and really made some shifts in the energy, I think. Because it's easy to get sucked up into the all that we have to do on Lopez. Like you say, wood stoves. Well, shoot, that means you got to, you know, take your chainsaw up, cut up, and buck up mm-hmm. a lot of wood. Well, there's, you know, there's a few days or a week's worth of work right there. And mm-hmm. add that with 5 acres and all the things that we do.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's not to mention your, you know, job.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, sometimes you have to work for a living, too. And that's
So how long have you been teaching?
Well, this is my 31st year. Yeah. Holly B. and I were talking the other day, and she said she's owned a bakery for, this is her 31st year in the bakery. How about that?
Yeah.
So it's quite a while.
And how many of those years have you taught on Lopez?
Well, about 18 or 19. Okay. I started to lose count. I taught 2 years at Shaw, and then a job opened up here, and I applied and was fortunate to get the job here. At that point, it was fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you started the ARC program.
Well, kind of. I didn't start it. It was done by Carol Steckler and Tiffany and Lisa and Hugh.
Okay.
And they were the ones that worked really hard to get the program going. And at the time, Elton Sorensen was the principal. He asked me to apply for the job. You had to have this interview with the families that were involved in it. So, and they were very clear that I was in kind of the extra, that they really wanted to run it as parents.
Oh.
And so they didn't even want to use the word teacher. So that was one of the hardest interviews I've ever done, is the interview with the parents of that program. And they decided they'd give me a shot at it. And so we spent the summer getting the classroom ready. And this was an alternative program that, you know, Lopez has tried lots of different things. And, you know, blessings on these people that put all this energy and time and research into what they wanted for their kids. And, you know, I felt grateful to be able to be the educator, or not even the educator. I can't even remember what the name of it was. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then 3 weeks or 2 weeks before we opened our doors, that's when Hugh Lawrence found out about the brain tumor.
Oh.
And that, at that point, Carol and Lisa and Tiffany and Hugh really concentrated on, is he going to live or die? And the program fell into my hands at that point, and I had to take it from there. But it was a, you know, I'm sorry for some of the conflict and emotional things that it caused, and there's lots of history on that, and we can go back into and say why it happened or why it didn't. But it's really, if I said what I, an education that I'm the most proud of, my work in the ARC program is, I think, what I would say would be my masterpiece in education, or what I'm most proud of. We had a wonderful group of kids, a very diverse group of parents that, you know, went from, you know, right-wing Christian to all-out, down-and-out hippie, you know. But we gathered in a circle, and we focused on the kids. And we pulled together in ways that really was phenomenal. And we were able to get out of the classroom quite a bit. And I think if you talk to many of the kids, it was, you know, an experience they value.
And very innovative for the day.
Well, not innovative in that it was happening all over the country, but innovative here. Mm-hmm. And the beauty was that I got to work with a lot of parents, and not in isolation like we normally do as teachers. Mm-hmm. So it was a fascinating time. And
only possible if you had parents who really were willing to put in time.
Well, that was one of the great myths. Because parents could have other people put in time for them, but a lot of the parents did. But if parents couldn't, you could have somebody else do your hours.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a combination of people, and it was multi-age and a lot of experiential education. The word alternative is a bad word because it means so many different things, okay. But it was really experiential.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did that for 5 years, and that's when we went to England. Mm-hmm. And left that. But we did some interesting things before. Pat Burleson and I did a combination fifth grade combination where parents could choose to have Pat for 2 years or have me for 2 years, or Pat for one and myself for one. And that's when, Laura, you and I went out to the beach that time.
Mm-hmm.
When I came here, I don't, you know, when you're a new teacher, you don't know what the heck you're doing. And you just try to figure it out. And when my first year teaching, I had little third graders, and I thought, I was in love with backpacking and the ocean. And so I said, all right, we're going to go take a hike out to the ocean. Well, third graders are so small, they can't carry anything. So here I had all these little tiny things with great big backpacks on. And, you know, we barely made it out there and survived.
Out where? Tell us where.
Okay, Sandpoint, at the park. But I feel like I feel I can take credit for some of the change in the rules because... at one point at Lopez, believe it or not, I had a class of 33 kids. Well, I said, well, go to the ocean anyway. And, you know, by the time we had parents, we had a contingent of 45.
I was in that class. My son Robert was in your fifth grade class. That was a huge group of people going all the way out to, what beach were we at?
It's Sandpoint is the name of it. So that's the beach. And mm-hmm. it's out of Lake Ozette. And so... what we would do, because I wasn't into light backpacking then, is we would carry Coleman stoves. And so we designed these carts to go down the trail. Okay, and I had a contest for the kids who could design the best cart.
All right.
Well, the trail, of course, is a boardwalk with steps. And, oh, my God, you wouldn't believe it. So we measured the carts to be the right length. And, of course, one of the carts was only just had an inch leeway on either side. And going down the trail, it was going off all the time. And we finally, you know, abandoned one cart and had to do a couple trips. And it was amazing. And then the thing we found worked the best was one of those baby carriers that had one wheel in the front and two in the back.
Oh, okay.
And that worked great. But the next year we went out with our carts and there's a big sign, no carts allowed.
Oh, really?
So I guess the Park Service didn't like what we did.
But this was, how many days was that trip?
Oh, it's varied, but it's 3 or 4 nights.
Yeah. Yeah,
and the student that's gone the most was my daughter Lily, because we took her out when she was a year and a half, and I think she'd done 4 beach hikes by the time she was 5 or 6 years old.
And then she went that year when we went, and I remember you sent, and I hope it's not telling any tales, but some of the girls on that trip, that fifth grade trip, were having some problems between them, and there was some conflict going on, and I remember you sent Lily into their tent, little Lily, 4 years old. And the girls just changed their focus. They started treating Lily like the little baby doll and looking after her, and all of a sudden the conflict seemed to have been gone.
They came out happy, yeah. Well, one of the keys, too, was, you know, when parents go on it, you have to separate parents and kids, because then you know, kids always save the worst for their parents. Mm-hmm. And I know I had Tina Ming at one point, and Jennifer had my daughter Lily, who was just a little runt at the time. And we're hiking down the trail, and Lily literally fell asleep standing up. Oh. And Jennifer caught her and carried her the rest of the way. And I could handle Tina's moaning and groaning a little bit, so it worked out just fine.
Nice.
But yeah, and we still do the ocean trip, only now I have eighth graders, and we've now go from Third Beach south, and we hike 7 miles down to Toliac Point. A little bit more arduous because the kids are bigger.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we've had some great adventures. So I've probably, over my years, I've done 25 of the trips to the ocean.
Holy smoke. You know, you mentioned maybe 10 minutes earlier that Camp Nor'wester was one of the things that brought you to Lopez. I know Camp Nor'wester looms very large for the community of Lopez. It holds a very special place in the communal history of Lopez Island. And I wonder if you could talk about Camp Nor'wester a little bit, Greg, maybe what it meant to you, or maybe some of the stories that you have.
Yeah, well, camp obviously brought me to Lopez, and I got to know Lopez and appreciated Lopez because of camp. But a couple things. One is, once I was teaching here, we could use the camp during the year. And we did a number of events in the longhouse there that Bill Holm built, and very, very special, that we could take kids out and spend the night there and cook salmon in traditional Indian style and experience how people lived here thousands of years ago. And I think camp was an integral part. I mean, it was a real loss to have the camp move off to John's Island. And, of course, there's a lot of hard feelings there. And if I had my druthers, I mean, Spiden Island came up for sale shortly afterwards, and that would have been probably a better place for Paul Allen at that point rather than the camp. But so it was a very special place. And, so, you know, events have been taking place. I was thinking earlier today, or yesterday, there's a rainbow. And when Sandy Bill passed away, his ceremony or celebration of his life was at the camp. And driving down, there's this incredible double rainbow that ended right at the camp. And another one was Rod, who started the Bay Cafe. He died of AIDS, and they built a coffin out of cedar for his ashes and put it through traditional Northwest Indian, and I don't know the name of it, is they have a carving over two poles, and if you come through that, you're friends, and it's a way to come and visit another tribe. But we carried the coffin through there and lit it on fire and pushed it out into the water, and it was absolutely stunning. And Rod was, you know, as many people are on this island, are very amazing. Rod was quite an unusual man. When I designed my house, I took it to him, and he was in bed at that point with the AIDS virus really had advanced at that point. But I had him look at my design, and there's a whole number of changes I made because of him. But one of the things he did was he designed extravagant dollhouses. And he had this whole notebook of absolutely beautiful dollhouses that were stunning. And I'm sure all of us on Lopez, probably the thing I appreciate aside from community and the support that we all give each other, is how you meet someone and the layers that we have underneath there of people, where they may on one surface be a carpenter, but on another layer there's different aspects. Like Rod designed these beautiful dollhouses. Or another classic example, we had a Chinese exchange teacher living with us, and Hawk Arps, who is obviously a fabulous musician and very excellent carpenter. We went to some gathering, and next thing I know, he's over talking to this Chinese woman in Mandarin, you know, just fluent Mandarin. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute.
Well, we discovered that again and again at Kindred Spirits, didn't we?
We did. We did. It was, yeah. That was quite a treat. And to go and actually just listen to people's stories for hours and hours.
And find out that every single person was a jewel.
Yeah. That was a wonderful project. And, of course, we've been asked to do it again, but life has gone on. And, of course, Iris and Summer have now put out a beautiful book in a different way.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to mention that Ron Morgan's name is memorialized in Morgantown, of course, the first land trust community.
That's
that he
right.
was very much involved in.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, that thinking of kindred spirits and thinking of special people on Lopez reminds me of Helen Anderson, also a remarkable person who devoted a good bit of her life, like you have, to youth, to the kids on this island. And I know Helen was really special to you, Greg.
She was very special. She really was the person that started Kindred Spirits. Because not only was her presence absolutely magnificent, but she just visually, she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. And she would tell stories at the library, and obviously we have the Helen Anderson Children's Room. And I'll never forget one time watching her tell stories, and she had shingles at the time, and she was shaking. But she had every child just riveted to her stories. And she did an absolutely amazing thing, because she, before she left the island, she called up a number of people, and I was one of them. And she had a book collection that you would not believe. Of course, she's this librarian, and she knew I loved bears, and she, of course, started the Teddy Bear Picnic. And I was a teddy bear one time, and what a treat that my daughter Clara was the teddy bear at the Teddy Bear Picnic this year. So,
oh, really?
To see that it continues on. But she knew I had this affinity for bears and my totem animal, so she said, look, I want you to come and pick out these books. I pulled them aside and set them aside for you, and come and get these books. Hmm. And I don't know how many people she called up, but I came, and she had probably a stack of 10 or 20 books, and she said, if there's anything else you want, go ahead. And this was a room, 10 by 12 room, from floor to ceiling with books. And so I took these books and took them home and then started opening them up. And there were probably at least 10 or 20 little articles, or little notes that she hand wrote and put in each book. And it just made me wonder, of all the books that she had, that not only had she read them, but she had connected this book with this article or with this situation. Mm-hmm. And I knew she was moving, and I said, Helen, I've always wanted to take a picture of you and photograph you. And she said, well, of course, you'd never wanted a photograph. So I did. I finally got over there with my camera and took a photograph, which I love dearly. It's a beautiful photograph of her. And then, got the books and so forth, and found out later, 3 months later or so, that she passed away. And she had cancer but didn't let anybody know. And so here, it was like almost a Native American potlatch. You know, she invited people and gave away, but didn't just give it away randomly. She gave away very specifically the gifts. So she's, a very, very special person on this island. And Helen and I definitely shared love of children, and we would take certain kids now and then, and both of us focus on helping certain children on the island.
Mm. You mentioned that Helen Anderson kind of started Kindred Spirits. For those listeners who do not know about Kindred Spirits, maybe Laurie should fill them in a little bit. Okay. Not everybody
That's
is familiar.
True. Everybody wouldn't know her. So Kindred Spirits is a book that Greg and I collaborated on. We began it in about 1996, I think, maybe. It's a book of photographs, extraordinary photographs, and interviews with 32, how many people did we interview?
32
people here on Lopez Island.
And 8 vignettes.
And 8 vignettes, in which we asked people the unanswerable questions of life. You know, why are we here? What are we, why did we come? What happens when we die? What should we be doing with our lives when we're here? All those unanswerable questions. And the youngest person we interviewed was Greg's daughter, Emma, who was 8 at the time.
Seven.
And the eldest was...
Who was
Andy
it?
Andy Holland.
Andy Holland, maybe.
91, I think,
yeah.
At the time.
Yeah. But I wouldn't say they're unanswerable questions, because people would talk for hours answering the questions.
That is for sure. That's for sure. How would you describe the questions we asked?
Well, I think you did a good job. I was going to say, when I photographed Helen, I went home, and the next day you called me up and said, look, I'm looking for something to do. Do you, you know, I'm a writer. Do you know anything? And I had just gotten back from Helen, and I said, you know, I have a job for you. It's not going to pay anything, and we're going to work really hard. But so it was absolutely phenomenal that you called right after that. Yeah. And the sad part is Helen moved away and passed away before we could ever interview her. So right.
She was going to be our first interview. I remember that very clearly.
And initially, my thought of a book that you could never have, going back to what you had asked earlier about how people started on Lopez, was if you could go back to the beginning when people first moved here and photograph them and interview them, and then every 5 years do the same with the same people, I think it'd be very, very fascinating to see how, what happens as we get older, as we have children, politically, what are our views, what happens in terms of living spaces. Mm-hmm. And the people that inspired that, actually, were Steve and Laura Adams for me. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, Laura is this amazing artist, and now she's an artist with wood and cabinets, but she can do anything, really, with design. And they moved up from California, and I never saw it, but apparently had this outdoor kitchen that Martha Stewart would have died for, you know. And, well, except Martha Stewart went to jail. Probably I should use somebody else. But anyway, and what happened, of course, was, again, one of the Lopez stories was that Laura, you know, had breast cancer, and very severe, and she survived it. And after that, they created a more comfortable living space than their initial space. And it always struck me that what is it that take somebody to go from the teepee living or whatever, the outhouse, to something that's more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. What the catalyst is.
Yeah, yeah, and it varies for all of us, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody on Lopez has a story related to that, and we heard a lot of them when we did Kindred Spirits.
We heard a lot of them, that is for sure.
And I think a lot of it was to save marriages, but...
You know, Greg, I was thinking of the coming-of-age ceremonies that we have on Lopez, because that seems also pretty special. You don't find that everywhere. Do you remember how that started? And
well,
could you tell something about
that? Well, I'm not the person to talk to about how it started. That would be Greg Blomberg, who's really held the light for that for years and years and years in really a very powerful way. But I can tell you the power of it for our family, which both Lily and Emma have done a coming of age. And summer solstice is a very special event in my book. It's a way that people gather in community and support each other. But also more recently, the coming of age has become, I think a number of kids have gone through that, and they spend a couple nights on an island with no food, just water and whatever that means to them, and then come back into the community. And it's an ancient celebration. I was so struck watching my daughter Lily come on the kayak with flowers and this face of a young girl that's becoming a woman, being out in the wilderness for 2 days and coming between a line of people with drumming and all the support of this community and some of the ceremony that goes around that. I know for Lily, you know, she's a creature of many worlds, you know. I mean, her goal is to go into fashion and self-esteem and psychology and how dress and so forth affects people's view of themselves. At the same time, the coming of age was a very important piece for her internally, and I know she wrote a wonderful paper about that experience for her. And the same thing with Emma. Both of them, it was a wonderful event. And
can you describe it in a little more graphically? I've not been to one, but I've heard things like, and maybe it's just been exaggerations about wrapping the mother and the son in kelp and then cutting them apart. I'd like to hear the details.
Well, you know, there's some ceremony around it, and the kelp gets wrapped, and the idea is that you're breaking free, you're now becoming your own person, and that you're part of the community, and that we're all your adults, your mothers, your fathers. It's a larger scale than that. And, I think the internal aspect of what the kids go through is very powerful, and you know, there's a chance for the men and the women to let the initiates know that, you know, we care about them, we love them, and we'll support them, and if they ever need any help or support, it will be there. And I think that's the beauty of Lopez in many, many different levels. I mean, that's one aspect, is the summer solstice. But, you know, we've seen it time and time again. I mean, when Hugh Lawrence got sick, for 6 months, there was food on their table. Mm-hmm. And people came and sang in their home. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll never forget passing of Jeff Hewins, who was beloved by many different people in the community. And there was representatives from 3 or 4 different churches and, you know, all gathered out at Natalie Rausch's place at the time. And celebrated the life of this amazing young man. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just one more aspect of celebration. You know, and well, we were talking earlier about Halloween. You know, I mean, you know, there's another one. One of my favorite events of the year is the pumpkin carving, which Liz and Terry started. And I know you can talk to them. I don't know exactly why, but it started in, you know, one of the outbuildings down at the South End. And after 3 or 4 years, that it became a bigger event and became in Woodman Hall, now Woodman Hall. And what a wonderful thing when all the pumpkins are carved and the lights go out and you only see these pumpkin faces. And I've been involved in some of the storytelling, as other people have. And we have a tradition of telling, you know, good old Halloween stories. And, of course, sometimes it's gotten a little scary. And
you like to tell scary stories. That's what I heard.
Well, no, I try to keep them calm. But we've had events. And my friend here... Allie, she's been out there telling with us too. So
yeah, well, she tells gentle stories. That's what I heard.
Well, mine aren't so scary. But we did have one time there was kind of it wasn't me, but somebody else, where all the young people were being hauled out quickly. But
taken on to laps, yeah.
Yeah, and we had a series of the Great Pumpkin and all sorts of things. But that's what a great event. Mm. What a great event that everybody gets together and carves the pumpkins and kids can celebrate. Well, Halloween's a great event. I mean, for kids, let's face it. How many days a year can you go knock on someone's door, demand candy, and get it? You know?
Yeah, but our way of doing it really is special, seeing all those kids. That was one of the first things we did when our family, when we moved here in 94, I remember, was going to, the boys learned to juggle.
Right.
Maybe Christopher was teaching, maybe you were teaching. It was up at the school one night of the week. It was after school time.
Right. Christopher and Scott were doing that one night a week, yeah.
Okay. So the boys started learning how to juggle, and then Halloween came rolling around really quick, and they We all went and carved our pumpkins. There must be 100 pumpkins on that stage.
Oh, at least. I mean, at least. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the, you know, the Juggle Fest, of course, has gone on for years, and I learned to, when I was teaching at Lakeside, I learned to juggle, and we had a little traveling troupe at Lakeside that went around Seattle and did birthday parties in other schools. I'm not that good of a juggler. I mean, Scott and Chris and Paul Lewis and all those guys are the real jugglers. I kind of stopped learning a long time ago. But I did have one class, my second class at Lopez, I think, that I call them my non-school kids. They were kids that didn't want to sit in the classroom. So we taught them to juggle. And I had 17 of them. And by the end of the year, 9 of them could juggle fire clubs, which was pretty amazing. So we thought, well, in celebration of all these kids that could perform, one student couldn't juggle, but he learned to ride the unicycle. And so we had all sorts of things going on. And so we decided to put on a performance for the community. So, of course, we'd never really done the fire clubs inside before. And they had just learned a little bit, but we were going to give it a shot anyway. So we had, you know, some acts going on and apple eating contests and a unicycle going and so forth and so on. And then came the finale of the fire clubs. And sure enough, they had dipped him in the kerosene too much. And so they pulled him out and there was this huge ball of fire, of course. And they're going, oh my God, I don't know. And so I said, go ahead, see what you can do. And of course, we had the lights too low, but we turned the lights up so they could do it, and they started juggling. Well, of course, all the smoke went up and set off the smoke alarm. So the smoke alarm's going off, and it was kind of a strobe show, really, with the light flashing and the bells ringing. And thank goodness Pat Burleson saved me. She went and got on the phone and told the fire trucks to stay home. It's just, it's not a real fire. But that's the last time I ever did a juggling show with kids.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, Allie, is there anything else on our list? Or we pretty well...
I'm checking my list, and I think we just about covered what I wrote down.
Yeah.
Do you have anything, Greg, that you would like to talk about?
Any last... I guess I want to ask you any last comments about community, which seems like it's been a bit of a theme here tonight.
Well, I mean, I think we can... Probably a lot of us can go back and think about events that have happened in our community. And sometimes it's tragic, sometimes it's celebrations, you know. And to me, if I look back on Lopez, you know, it's really a highlight thinking of all the many, many events that I've seen. And maybe this is too fresh, but... I was in Nicaragua when David Fisher passed here this last year, and very hard for all of us. And we gathered in Nicaragua, and you know, we really wanted to be up here on Lopez with everybody. And we gathered there and talked about David, and you know, what a wonderful member of the community was, and so forth. And at the same time that people were gathered up on Fish's property. But what struck me, it's kind of an odd thought maybe, but that if something ever happened to me, my wife and kids would be taken care of. Mm. And I thought, what a gift that on Lopez we take care of each other. And, you know, in Fisher's case, it was amazing. You know, all of a sudden their house was completed and things were taken care of. And, you know, I go back to Hugh Lawrence. Or then on the other hand, there's a wonderful wedding that I went to that a lot of us went to when Hawk and Heather got married. And they had lived here for, I don't know, 10, 12 years. And, of course, went through a really hard time with Kestrel, who was, you know, sick when he was younger and got a lot of support. And what a wonderful thing for this couple that we all knew and loved to get married later after they'd been together for a while. So, you know, I think of, I mean, there's 20, 30, 40, 50 events that have happened. And every time it happens, you say, what a gift that we live on Lopez. Another one that I remember is Phil Hastings. Before he passed away, he had a big party. Mm. And I thought, what a great thing to have a party and say hi or goodbye to everybody before you die.
Is that what he had in mind?
You know, we never know, do we?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But it sure seemed that that was a piece of it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, here we are, we can say, Phil, how much we love you and how much we care for you. And, you know, and the beauty, I think, too, is in spite of differences that we have, we find ways to come together. And
again and again and again.
It is. And, you know, we may be philosophically different, politically different, financially different, but in the end, we pull together. And, you know, sure, some things linger and some people hang on to things, but, you know, for the most part, when someone needs something, it happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how many places, I mean, you know, we've all, not all, but I've lived in a city and suburbs where, you know, you didn't even know your neighbors, let alone if they're alive or not alive. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, to me, one of the beautiful things about Lopez and the community, that, especially raising kids here. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I think we're running out of time, but I'll tell you one quick story that is kind of sweet. It's like, when you raise kids here, you don't have to teach them to be afraid of the world. Mm-hmm. Because you go some event and they can roam, they can wander, you know. And where else can they go? I mean, what are they going to do? Go run on the ferry and run away, you know? So one time, Emma was just maybe 4 or 5, and we had gotten on the ferry, and I realized we were going off island, and we have not created this thing of don't talk to strangers and don't all the don'ts that you need to do if you're living in the city. And there was a woman leaning against the front of the ferry. It's a nice summer day, just absorbing the sun, with her legs crossed and her arms crossed, leaning back against the wall of the ferry there. And Emma looked up and down and up and down, and then leaned just like she did in the same position. And I thought, there's just not a barrier, you know, that they're willing to enter into other worlds. And I think, what a great gift that we can give our kids at Lopez.
Well, and what a great gift for everybody to hear you share your memories. Thank you very much, Greg. It was lovely.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. I thought I wasn't going to be able to talk for an hour, but...
No problem.
No problem at all. Well,
Go ahead, Al.
We are at the end of our hour, and we hope that many of you will listen again and again until we talk to you next month for another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez.
This program was pre-recorded.